Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we are coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada, affiliate talk radio, AM 640. Great to be back. Keeping our eye on this potential dam collapse up in Northern California, Oroville, California. Authorities ordered the evacuation of more than 100,000 residents in several Northern California towns as a rapidly eroding section of a dam appeared on the verge of collapse on the Facebook page at the county sheriff's office up there. They said, "This is not a drill." We will, as I say, keep an eye on that. Great to be back. I had a great time hosting Coast last night. Hope you enjoyed it as well. At least I'm told that we had a great time. How can I be sure? Right now I'm having amnesia and deja vu at the same time. I think I've forgotten this before. That's a line from one of my favorite comedians, Stephen Wright. But seriously, how do we know which memories are real? How can we be sure a remembrance about a past event isn't distorted or completely false? It turns out there's an astonishing variety of ways in which our brains can be led astray. And in the back half of the program, hours 3 and 4, Dr. Julia Shaw will reveal the amazing fallibility of our so-called power of recall. She'll explain how we can sometimes misappropriate other people's memories, subsequently believing them to be our own. She'll also explain how radically false memories can be deliberately implanted, leading people to believe that they brutally murdered a loved one or were abducted by aliens. And she'll reveal how, in spite of all this, we can improve our memory through simple awareness of its fallibility. Fascinating and unnerving in equal measure. That's hours 3 and 4. This month, in about a week and a half, we will mark the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Los Angeles, also known as the Great Los Angeles Air Raid. Shortly after 2 a.m. on Feb 25th, 1942, less than 3 months after the United States' entry into the war following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, air raid sirens wailed through Los Angeles. The military had ordered a total blackout of the L.A. area after unidentified objects were spotted soaring over the region. As terrified civilians braced for another possible surprise attack mounted by the Axis powers, the Coastal Artillery Brigade began firing a steady salvo of anti-aircraft shells. The mystery objects, as few as 9, as many as 25, according to reports, moved south from Santa Monica to Long Beach before disappearing. More than 1,400 shells were launched over a one-hour period, not one of which hit their targets. An all-clear was sounded after 7 a.m. the next morning. Security of the Navy Frank Knox called the incident a false alarm. Newspapers of the time published a number of reports and speculations of a cover-up. Of course, some contemporary ufologists have suggested the targets were extraterrestrial spacecraft. When documenting the incident in 1949, the United States Coast Artillery Association identified a meteorological balloon. Here we go with the meteorological balloons again. Sent up at 1 a.m. that started all the shooting and concluded that once the firing started, imagination created all kinds of targets in the sky and everyone joined in. In 1983, the U.S. Office of Air Force History attributed the event to a case of war nerves, triggered by a lost weather balloon and exacerbated by stray flares and shell bursts from adjoining batteries. Air raid sirens sounded throughout L.A. on that night. But what really happened? You know, several buildings and vehicles were damaged by shell fragments. 5 civilians died as an indirect result of the anti-aircraft fire, 3 killed in car accidents in the ensuing chaos, and 2 of heart attacks attributed to the stress of the hour-long action. The incident was front-page news along the U.S. Pacific Coast and earned some mass media coverage throughout the nation. Bill Burns, no stranger to Coast, New York Times best-selling author, magazine publisher, New York literary publishing agent, who has written and edited over 25 books and encyclopedias, will join us shortly to separate the wheat from the chaff as it pertains to the Battle of Los Angeles. And of course, Coast listeners, you're part of this program too. I will eagerly await your usual brilliance during the call-in portion with each guest. So, let's get started. My pledge to you is to do my level best and turn the next 4 hours into time well spent. Come on in, weary stranger, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather round the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Why don't you stay a while? As publisher of the nationally distributed UFO magazine, editor of the UFO Encyclopedia, published by Pocket Books, and co-author with the nation's top radio talk show host George Norrie of A Worker in the Light, Dr. William Burns has added to his list of publications in the UFO paranormal field, which include The Day After Roswell, Unsolved UFO Mysteries, The Haunting of the Presidents. He received his Ph.D. from New York University in 1974 while he was an instructor of English at Trenton State College in New Jersey, where he taught structural linguistics and historical linguistics, as well as literature and writing. Professor Burns was a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow, a Lilly Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, and a Grants Award Judge for the National Endowment for the Arts. And he's got a brand new book out we'll touch on during the course of the next 2 hours, called Edison versus Tesla, the battle over their last invention. But right now, we're going to discuss the Battle of Los Angeles. Bill Burns, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. And thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
My pleasure, indeed. All right. So take us back to the evening, February 24th, 25th, 1942. There is a great deal of panic. We had, of course, just a couple months prior, we had the attack on Pearl Harbor, and we also had another sort of submarine attack, minor damage, but an attack nonetheless, the first attack on the mainland around Santa Barbara. So there was a great deal of panic in Los Angeles.
There was. The Japanese did have vessels, submarines, off the west coast of the United States. And people on the west coast, the coastal cities, L.A. is a coastal city, Santa Barbara, they were in a panic. And there was fear that the Japanese were going to invade. Now, the military was confident they were not, but the Japanese, in fact, did launch attacks on the west coast of the United States and Alaska. There was a ground attack at Alaska. So there was that fear. Then on that evening, heading south over Santa Monica Bay, the anti-aircraft gunners, they spotted what they thought was a squadron of planes, and they thought they were, at first, they were Japanese planes. In fact, that's what they continued to think. And batteries up and down the coast from Santa Monica to Long Beach opened up their batteries. They were firing machine guns, 50 cals. But the big thing was the exploding artillery shells, anti-aircraft shells at the craft. They were caught by searchlights. I mean, this was such an obvious event where you could actually see these things in the air. It wasn't as though these were invisible and people were firing into thin air. You could see them. Searchlights pinpointed the craft. The craft turned up in photographs in the Los Angeles Times the next day, and despite almost 1,500 shells, I think it was 1,400 shells, but firing at this craft, nothing was hit. If it's a weather balloon, now think about some of the theories here. There were two separate occasions where people said, "Oh, it's a weather balloon. It got loose from its tether. It was flowing south." Triggered all these alarms. Either we have the most incompetent gunners at that point in history, or it wasn't a weather balloon. Because when you consider how slowly a weather balloon travels, when you consider that it's going with the air currents, which means that you can predict where it's going to be, when you can lay shells across a broad area, so that the craft, whatever it is going to go into the explosion as well as the explosion hitting the craft, why weren't they able to knock down the weather balloon, if that's the case? It just makes no sense.
Well, the weather balloon seems to be their go-to excuse. I mean, they dust that chestnut off 5 years later in Roswell.
Right. Well, weather balloons are very handy because they get lost. That's why people like weather balloons. And you really can't deny it. You can't really say, oh, well, it isn't a weather balloon. I mean, we can say that about Roswell for obvious reasons, and we can say that about this, but by and large, a weather balloon is a very innocent device to blame for an event that's they're claiming is misidentification. So the craft continues to go, and some people say there were as many as 10 planes, 15 planes, 20 planes. They continue to go. I think it's not 20 planes myself, and disappears. By 7 o'clock in the morning, the whole thing is over. The thing disappears between 6 and 7, and nobody knows what it is. So if it's a conventional aircraft, it's scary that these gunners couldn't hit it. That's what's very scary. And if it's a conventional aircraft, I mean, think about this. It's a conventional aircraft going into very heavy flak. Don't you think if it's on a real bombing mission, that's one thing, it's going to bomb something. If it's not on a real bombing mission and it's encountering heavy flak, don't you think that's going to change course very rapidly?
Precisely.
It didn't.
Precisely. Oh, there's so much of the story that just does not ring true.
Exactly. And the worst part of the damage was the damage along the ground. I think I have somewhere, I have a piece of shrapnel from that thing that a retired LAP officer had gotten from his father, who was on duty that night along the beach, along Redondo Beach. The very square, hard piece of shrapnel with sharp edges. A lot of that fell to earth and caused damage.
Sure.
Because when the shells exploded, that's the other thing. The amount of shrapnel that fell to earth. That also bothers me a lot.
Well, every one of those anti-aircraft shells, they weigh about 15 pounds.
That's right. So I mean, are you telling me there was... It seems as though, given all the shells that were fired and the amount of shrapnel that hit the beach and houses and cars and trees, didn't hit anything? Again, it makes no sense when you consider that these were coastal defense gunners. They were trained gunners. These were anti-aircraft weapons. We fired 1,400 shells. We blanketed the skies from Santa Monica to Long Beach with shells, with explosions from flak, all of which fell back to earth, and nothing was hit. And the craft kept on going in the same direction at a slow speed without changing direction.
Have you talked to any of the, well, you know, obviously most of the veterans who would have served with the 37th Coast Artillery Brigade and others, they would have, many of them would have passed on. But did you ever have an opportunity to speak to any of them or their family members?
We spoke to Scott Littleton, who was there that night as a kid. Now, it's the late Scott Littleton. He's dead, but back maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, there was a motion picture called Battle Los Angeles, and I was one of the people that the studio asked to do promotion for the film. Bob Salas and I were among those who did it, and Bob Salas from the Malmstrom Air Force case. And in that, we were able to get interviews with people who were there, who were very old, but who were there that night, and they described some of the panic. And when the air raid sirens went off early in the morning, a lot of people who lived along the beachfront, and if you know L.A. at all, you know there's Redondo Beach, there's Manhattan Beach, there's and from, I would say, Los Angeles Airport south, along Lincoln Boulevard, which is the coast, along Lincoln Boulevard, there is one beach community after another. And people, and there are houses near the beach. And if there not on the beach. They're one, 2 blocks away. People ran down to the beach to see what was going on. So on one level, it was a light show for folks who lived along the California coast. On another level, people in the city themselves were panic-stricken, but those who lived along the beach, yes, they were afraid, but they, as some died from heart attacks, at least 2 people died from heart attacks that night, or 3 people, but they ran out to see what was going on. So there were hundreds of witnesses that night to what was going on, in addition to members of the Coastal Artillery that were firing on the craft. And one of those, on film, folks could find it, describe what it was like when he ran out, and he was of a firm belief that this was not a conventional aircraft, that it wasn't a weather balloon, because he said when you saw this thing going, and he saw it with his own eyes, he said when you saw this thing going, you saw this thing that the shells were exploding all around it. See, that's the other thing. There were shells exploding all around this thing. So it wasn't as though there was, I mean, flak did hits by an explosion and shrapnel destroys the plane. And that's what was happening to this craft. Things were exploding all the way around it. So it wasn't just a miss. They were actually hitting the area where
the other thing was going. The other thing, Bill, is when you look at the newsreel footage and you see the searchlights. I mean, this mm-hmm. whatever this object is, there's a lot of searchlights focused on it.
Right.
And obviously, you know, we know that many things can be done with video. But to my eyes, when you look at it, those searchlights are hitting a physical object. There's some density there.
Yes, exactly. That's why it's so strange. It's not as though there was nothing there. They were firing at ghosts. They actually had something in their searchlights. Now, some people have said, again, using Photoshop, that they could see by changing the background a little, by bringing up the contrast, they could see that it was really a saucer shape. Okay. I mean, that's fine. But you're using Photoshop on a photo from 1942.
Right, right.
So I mean, yes, and the photo you're using is not the negative, and the photo you're using is not the original. The original, I'm assuming it was a Graflex camera, which newspapers had at that time. I'm assuming, and those are the big plates that they used, I'm assuming that they didn't have the Graflex plate or whatever was the original for the photo, that the person doing it was using a copy of a photo either from the internet or from a magazine, more likely from the internet, and that's what was being photoshopped. So you can imagine what generation that photo is that you're photoshopping to get the image you want in the first place.
Sure, obviously. This is photographic evidence, not that reliable. However,
but there was something there. That's the point. There was something there, something dark in the searchlights, a physical object that coastal gunners designed to defend the United States of America against an attack by bombers could not defend against because they missed it.
And the artillery brigades, one would assume that they would be equipped with some sort of, I don't know, obviously they'd have binoculars, they would have something.
Sure.
You know, they're not shooting into thin air, into the darkness. They see something.
Right.
Obviously.
And the searchlights had it. The searchlights had it pinned. So it's not as though the searchlights couldn't find it. There it was, and we couldn't hit it. Why? Were there any other incidents where unidentified objects were fired upon by the United States military, were hit by the United States military or other militaries with no damage whatsoever? And the answer is yes. Washington in 1952, Washington, D.C., and Chile in 1965, when one of the pilots who ended up testifying back in 2007 at the National Press Club, I'm trying to think of his name, said that flying his Su-22 at a circular object overhead near a military parade in restricted airspace, he fired his cannon at this craft. He hit the craft with no damage whatsoever. And again, in 1952, there were U.S. jets who locked their radar train guns on craft, fired, and did not hit them. So other situations have occurred like this.
So the idea here is that these mortar shells or this artillery barrage, it didn't pass through the object. It's a physical object. They simply what? Bounced off. I guess that's the idea.
Or the object was not vulnerable, was invulnerable to their explosions. Let's say the object had a force field.
All right, listen, we'll pick up on that point, Bill, on the other side. Here's a Joe Cocker taking us into the break with Delta Lady, back with more of my conversation with Bill Burns as we discuss the Battle of Los Angeles, the 75th anniversary, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. This is R.B. Greaves and Take a Letter, Maria. And throughout the evening, I've been dropping in some Stax Records tunes, paying homage to a great label. And R.B. Greaves, they were kind of mining that, looking for that Otis Redding sound, and R.B. Greaves certainly had that. We are talking about the upcoming 75th anniversary of the Battle of Los Angeles, back in February of 1942. Panic swept over Los Angeles County, a blackout, the 37th Artillery Brigade firing something like anywhere between 1,400 and 2,000 artillery shells, mortar shells, at this unidentified flying object. And the next morning, after the all clear was given, and when nothing was hit, there was some damage to buildings because of the falling shells and so forth. Five people died, three in car accidents in the ensuing chaos, two from heart attacks. The next day, the U.S. military said, well, this was just a case of war nerves. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along. Let's have a little listen. I believe this was the local CBS affiliate in Los Angeles reporting on the event as it happened.
And now for news of our own West Coast, we take you to Los Angeles and the report of Byron Palmer. Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp. However, it required nearly 30 minutes to travel some 25 miles. Far slower than an airplane. Watchers on the rooftop of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood could plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area. Concussion of the shells could be felt in downtown Los Angeles, 15 miles away. U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark skies, but whether they contacted the object has not been announced. Army officials say they will not comment until they receive a full report of the action. Although some watchers say they saw airplanes in the air, semi-official sources say they probably were the U.S. Army's pursuit. Several observers say they saw one or more planes spotlighted by 20 or 30 searchlights. The object moved southward, presumably over Huntington Park at the western edge of Los Angeles, and on southward to about Long Beach on the coast. By 3:30 a.m., observers said the object appeared to be over the south of Long Beach. Searchlights closely followed the object down the coast and kept it centered in their glare. Shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit it. The shooting stopped about 3:30 a.m. The shooting brought warfare to the front door of this city of 1.25 million population for the first time since December 7th.
All right, there's a little bit of that CBS report. I love the reference to Los Angeles by the reporter. We'll get back to our conversation with ufologist author Bill Burns in just a few moments. Just want to let you in on this, an opportunity to enjoy the grand experience with George Norrie live. When radio comes to the stage, that's happening May the 6th 2017, from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. May 6th. It's fast approaching. And you get George's first live stage show of the year at the Plaza del Sol Performance Hall on the campus of California State University Northridge in Northridge, California. Guests include hypnotherapist and past life regression expert Dr. Bruce Goldberg, afterlife expert and near-death experiencer Danian Brinkley, author and contactee Whitley Strieber, and a meet-and-greet following the show. And the tickets are available at Ticketmaster, ticketmaster.com, or by calling 800-745-3000, 800-745-3000. Back to the Battle of Los Angeles when Coast to Coast AM continues in moments. And we are back with New York Times best-selling author, magazine publisher Bill Burns. His books include UFO Hunters, The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney, The Haunting of 21st Century America. He has a new one out called Edison versus Tesla, The Battle Over Their Last Invention. Right now we're talking about the battle of another sort over at Los Angeles back in February of 1942. Bill, your thoughts as you, I'm not sure if you could hear that, we played a snippet of that 1942 original radio broadcast. Your thoughts about that original report?
CBS broadcast is really illuminating because you've got eyewitness accounts describing the event. And key in that description is the speed of the object traveling south from Santa Monica to Long Beach. The reports are that it was going too slow for an airplane. Now, if it's going too slow for an airplane, in other words, it's going so slow the plane couldn't stay in the air. If it's going that slowly, then the question is, again, why wasn't it hit by the anti-aircraft? And why were the shells seen exploding around it if it is going so slowly that it isn't a plane? And if it's a balloon, why wouldn't the shrapnel from the shells be puncturing the balloon? I mean, it just makes no sense. So that's one of the problems, and that's one of the very intriguing things about the CBS description of the event as it was happening.
The conflicting reports about whether or not fighter planes were actually scrambled to intercept. What are your thoughts?
The official report says that fighter planes were grounded, that there was no intercept. Now, you can understand why there wouldn't be an intercept, because the Army Air Force knew that these weren't Japanese planes. That's really the best answer. Also, would you want your military aircraft to be flying into a barrage of anti-aircraft shells from your own gunners? Of course not. So the Army Air Force had grounded planes that night. And the fact that coastal artillery gunners would be mistaking a flight of U.S. military planes for Japanese planes and firing on them and missing them also makes no sense. I mean, wouldn't you think that if an American fighter squadron, an American interceptor squadron, was taking fire from shore batteries, from friendly fire shore batteries, they wouldn't radio back to base to shut those batteries down? The firing continued for hours along the California coast. So that takes out the fact that these are military planes. Also, why would military planes stay in the area going slowly down the coast being fired upon? That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So I don't think these were planes. I think it's an object.
Right, right. And a lot of the newspapers, there was an editorial in the Long Beach Herald, and they were talking about a cover-up. They're saying there's something going on here, we're not getting the full story. So obviously, I mean, even the Fourth Estate was not satisfied with the official version of events, that this was simply panic and war nerves or mass hallucination.
Because it was implausible that this event would take place and there'd be no concrete results from this event. That's the implausibility of this, that every story the government put out, it's a weather balloon, it's a meteorological test balloon or something, it's a dirigible. Every argument that was officially put out was implausible. If it were a balloon traveling that slowly, why wasn't the thing hit by anti-aircraft? If we didn't have an idea what that object might be, why weren't American planes sent to intercept the object? Even before the anti-aircraft. I mean, in the Battle of Britain, you had Spitfires vectoring towards the German bombers before they crossed the mainland, before they crossed the English Channel, or before they reached British airspace, because they knew where they would be. Here was something that was, it was obvious where it was. It was moving very slowly. It was taking hours to reach some destination, and nobody could hit it. So there was not one spotter plane in the area that could have seen this thing. No, that's why the newspapers were really bothered by this thing. Why? I mean, just think of this from a national security perspective. Just forget whether it's a UFO or not. Think of it only from a national security perspective. Do you mean, the newspapers are asking, that an object appears over the west coast of the United States, over Los Angeles, over the Los Angeles area, because it was 15 miles away, over the Los Angeles area, and not one gunner could hit this thing, not one interceptor was aloft to shoot this thing down? What's going on here? This has national security implications, especially in light of the earlier Japanese shelling of Santa Barbara. Yes, it was shelling from a submarine. Yes, there was a seaplane attack. Yes, all that's true. But Los Angeles area, but western the coast of California was attacked by the Japanese. That's a fact. Now, you're telling me that when this happened, not one gunner could hit this thing, that it clearly was moving too slowly for an airplane, and no interceptors were in the air to shoot this thing down. What is it about national security in wartime?
Big trouble. I mentioned Long Beach, the newspaper. It was the Long Beach Independent. Here's a snippet of the editorial. There is a mysterious reticence about the whole affair, and it appears that some form of censorship is trying to halt discussion on the matter. And then there was a call for a congressional investigation. It was Representative Leland Ford of Santa Monica. Was there an investigation? What came of it?
No, there really wasn't any investigation because the Army, it's a lot like what happened when Jerry Ford went to Mendel Rivers about the investigation of UFOs, the House Science and Aeronautics Committee, or when Professor James McDonald testified before Congress about UFOs, or about Project Blue Book. When the subject, even tangentially, even Barack Obama said on Between Two Pines, whatever that thing is with Zach Galifianakis, that they ask us not to talk about this. I mean, he said that. So when it comes to that, there is a reticence, and reticence is really the perfect word to use. It's not as though they're going to lie to you per se. They're just going to find a way to cover up the truth. It's just that simple. The government did not want to talk about this. Consider what happened on the east coast of the United States just 2 years later in 1944, when the Germans, this was near the end of the war, this was after June 6th, after the invasion of Normandy, the Germans sent a fleet of U-boats toward the United States. These U-boats had launching ramps on their foredecks. Now, remember the Japanese had seaplane launchers on their foredecks of their submarines?
Right,
well, these
right.
German U-boats had launch ramps on their foredecks. They were launching, they would surface, they would launch guided missiles. They would launch V-1s at the United States with the thought of bombing American cities for the first time. Would it have been effective? No. If the Germans figured out what a detonation fuse was for an atomic bomb, yes, it would have been effective. So, I mean, here was a case where that was covered. That German U-boat attack on the United States was heavily covered in the New York Times in 1944, toward the end of the year. Heavily covered. There were screams from Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia of New York that the East Coast wasn't being defended heavily enough in case of a German bombing attack on East Coast cities. That was wide open. There was full transparency of that. Yet on the West Coast, 2 years earlier, there's silence. No, there was not an investigation.
Talk to me about the history of UFO sightings, particularly coming out of the water. around Los Angeles, unidentified submerged objects, and UFOs. The coastal water surrounding LA.
Yeah, well, what's fascinating about that is that the Redondo Trench on Santa Monica Bay, between, let's say, Redondo and Catalina Island, which is 26 miles across the sea, there is a very deep trench. And this is an area where there have been a lot of sightings of UFOs. In fact, Santa Monica Bay had a lot of sightings of UFOs. We spoke to a few of them on UFO Hunters, a bunch of the eyewitnesses. There was certainly a UFO landing on Carnotto Island off San Diego on the west coast of the United States, off the city of San Diego, in conjunction with some Bill Clinton presentation there. And there were teenage witnesses who actually saw these creatures come down on Carnotto Island. We interviewed them. It was traumatic for them. If you go through the records of the Lost Hills Sheriff Station outside of Malibu, you will hear 9/11 calls of people saying there are strange sights over Santa Monica Bay of craft they could see. And of course, I think the most famous sighting of a USO, an unidentified submersible object, over Santa Monica Bay would have been by Ronald and Nancy Reagan as they were driving. And this was confirmed by their daughter, by Lucille Ball, but by their daughter, Patty Davis, when they were driving down Pacific Coast Highway towards Hollywood for a party for William Holden, the movie star William Holden, William Holden. And they were driving toward a birthday party with him. And they saw a craft over PCH head out into Santa Monica Bay and into the water. And Reagan was very enthusiastic about UFOs. He had two sightings. And he talked about it at the party. And Lucille Ball talked about what he talked about. Nancy Reagan, not so much, but Ronald Reagan, yes. And his daughter, Patty Davis, talked about it and said, yes, he was very enthusiastic about that. So that is probably the most famous sighting of a USO off the coast of California. But you can hear a lot of them have been made public. 9/11 calls to the Lost Hills Sheriff Station about what was happening off the coast of Malibu. And, of course, Point Doom is off Malibu is a very important spot. People have said there are submarine entrances there, that USOs use this. So that is a very strong hotspot for UFO sightings.
And so, Bill, in your estimation, is that what this craft was? Is that where it came from?
It could have been, because it disappeared. It didn't fly away. It just disappeared. How about if it disappeared by going underwater, by simply going underwater? So I think there is when you give the long, long history of UFO and USO sightings off the coast of California, when you look at the idea of what this Redondo Beach Trench is, that it is very deep. I mean, it is a natural submarine channel, and where you can lurk undetected. And if you just look at the whole history of USO, going back to 1492, right? Columbus had the first documented sighting in the Western Hemisphere of a craft in the water, alight, going out of the water and flying off into the stars. And he was so, Christopher Columbus was so excited about that, that he asked the person who was keeping his log to make sure that an entry, and it was in 1492, right before they made landfall near Hispaniola, and it was an entry in his log, and that's how we know that he had that sighting. So USOs are, 500, 600 years they've been sighted.
Yeah, and when we say USO, we're not talking about, Bob Hope and Anne Margaret.
Exactly.
We'll come back, we'll open up the phone lines, Bill. We'll take questions and comments about the Battle of Los Angeles. And we'll get into, well, I received an email yesterday, and I want to share that with you when we come back as well. And that is someone who said that there was actually some sort of material fragment found on the ground and analyzed. And perhaps there are others out there listening who have similar reports to share. Bill Burns, my guest, the Battle of Los Angeles and your phone calls on the other side when Coast to Coast continues. Here is, let's see, who do we have coming up? We've got You Got It, Bonnie Raitt.